You know, I'd have donated some if you'd asked. And missed the fun of negotiating? Noadan said. He borrowed the merchant's pen, then crossed an item off his list. There is satisfaction, he said to Dalinar, in creating a list of things you can actually accomplish, then removing them one at a time. As I said, a simple joy.
Unfortunately, I'm needed for bigger things than shopping.
Isn't that always the problem? Tell me, my friend, you talk about your burdens and the difficulty of the decision. What is the cost of a principle?
The cost? There shouldn't be a cost to being principled.
Oh? What if making the right decision created a spren who instantly blessed you with wealth, prosperity, and unending happiness? What then? Would you still have principles? Isn't a principle about what you give up, not what you gain?
So it's all negative, Dalinar said. Are you implying that nobody should have principles because there's no benefit to them?
Hardly, Noadan said. But maybe you shouldn't be looking for life to be easier because you choose to do something that is right. Personally, I think life is fair. It's merely that often you can't immediately see what balances it.
He wagged the finger he'd used to tip the merchant's scales.
If you'll forgive a somewhat blatant metaphor, I've grown fond of them. You might say I wrote an entire book about them.
This is different from the other visions, Dalinar said. What's going on?
The thumping from before returned. Dalinar spun, then charged out of the tent, determined to get a look at the thing. He saw it above the buildings, a stone creature with an angular face and red spots glowing deep in its rocky skull.
Storms! And he had no weapon.
Noadan stepped from the tent, holding his bag of grain. He looked up and smiled. The creature leaned down, then offered a large, skeletal hand. Noadan touched it with his own, and the creature stilled.
"This is quite the nightmare you've created," Noadan said. "What does that thunderclast represent, I wonder?"
"Pain," Dalinar said, backing away from the monster. "Tears. Burdens. I'm a lie, Noadan. A hypocrite."
"Sometimes a hypocrite is nothing more than a man who is in the process of changing."
Wait, hadn't Dalinar said that? Back when he'd felt stronger? More certain?
Other thumps sounded in the city. Hundreds of them. Creatures approaching from all sides, shadows in the sun.
"All things exist in three realms, Dalinar," Noadan said. "The physical, where you are now, the cognitive, what you see yourself as being, the spiritual, the perfect you, the person beyond pain and error and uncertainty."
Monsters of stone and horror surrounded him, heads cresting roofs, feet crushing buildings.
"You've said the oaths," Noadan called, "but do you understand the journey? Do you understand what it requires? You've forgotten one essential part, one thing that without which there can be no journey."
The monsters slammed fists toward Dalinar and he shouted,
"What is the most important step a man can take?"
Dalinar awoke, huddled in his bed in Urethiru, asleep in his clothing again. A mostly empty bottle of wine rested on the table. There was no storm. It hadn't been a vision. He buried his face in his hands, trembling. Something bloomed inside of him. A recollection. Not really a new memory. Not one he'd completely forgotten, but it suddenly became as crisp as if he'd experienced it yesterday. The night of Gavilar's funeral.
104. Strength. Ashurtmarn, the heart of the revel, is the final of the three great, mindless unmade. His gift to men is not prophecy or battle focus, but a lust for indulgence. Indeed, the great debauchery recorded from the court of Bayala in 480, which led to dynastic collapse, might be attributable to the influence of a Shirtmarn. From Hesse's Mythica, page 203. Navani Colin had some practice holding a kingdom together. During Gavilar's last days, he had gone strange. Few knew how dark he'd grown, but they had seen the eccentricity. Jasnah had written about that, of course. Jasnah somehow found time to write about everything, from her father's biography to gender relations to the importance of Chul breeding cycles on the southern slopes of the Horneater Peaks. Navani strode through the hallways of Urethiru, joined by a nice burly group of Bridge Four Windrunners. As Gavilar had grown more and more distracted, Navani herself had worked to keep squabbling Light Eyes from sundering the kingdom. But that had been a different kind of danger from the one she faced today. Today, her work had implications not only for one nation, but for the entire world. She burst into a room deep within the tower, and the four Light Eyes seated there scrambled to their feet, all but Sabariel, who appeared to be flipping through a stack of cards bearing pictures of women in compromising positions. Navani sighed, then nodded as Aladar gave her a respectful bow, light glinting off his bald head. Not for the first time, Navani wondered if his thin mustache and the tuft of beard on his bottom lip were compensation for his lack of hair. Hatham was there as well, refined, with rounded features and green eyes. As usual, his fashion choices stood out from everyone else. Orange, today. Brightness Bethab had come representing her husband. The men in the army tended to disrespect him for letting her do so, but that ignored the fact that marrying Mishina for her political acumen had been a wise and calculated move. The five men of Bridge Four arrayed themselves behind Navani. They had been surprised when she'd asked them to escort her. They didn't yet understand the authority they lent the throne. The Knights Radiant were the new power in the world, and politics swirled around them like eddies in a river. "Bright Lords and Bright Lady," Navani said, "I've come at your request and am at your service." Aladar cleared his throat, sitting.
"You know, Brightness, that we are the most loyal to your husband's cause."
"Or at the least," Sabariel added.
"We're the ones hoping to get rich by throwing in our lot with him."
"My husband appreciates the support," Navani said, "regardless of motive. You create a stronger Alethkar, and therefore a stronger world."
"What's left of either one?" Sabariel noted.
"Navani," Bright Lady Bethab said. She was a mousy woman with a pinched face. "We appreciate that you've taken the initiative in this difficult time."
There was a glint to her orange eyes, as if she assumed Navani was enjoying her new power.
"But the High Prince's absence is not advantageous for morale. We know that Dalinar has returned to his distractions."
"The High Prince," Navani said, "is in mourning."
"The only thing he seems to be mourning," Sabariel said, "is the fact that people won't bring him bottles of wine fast enough for—"
"Damnation, Turinad!" Navani snapped. "That's enough!"
Sabariel blinked, then pocketed his cards.
"Sorry, Brightness."
"My husband," Navani said, "is still this world's best chance for survival. He will push through his pain. Until then, our duty is to keep the kingdom running." Hatham nodded, beads on his coat glistening.
"This is, of course, our goal. But, Brightness, can you define what you mean by kingdom? You do know that Dalinar came to us and asked what we thought of this High King business."
That news wasn't commonly known yet. They'd planned an official announcement, and even had Elokar seal the papers before leaving. Yet Dalinar had delayed. She understood. He wanted to wait until Elukar and Adolin, who would become Kolin High Prince in Dalinar's place, returned. And yet, as more and more time passed, the questions began to grow more pressing. What had happened to them in Kolinar? Where were they? Strength. They would return.
The High King proclamation has not been made official, Navani said. I think it's best to pretend you don't know about it for now. And whatever you do, don't mention it to ELA or Amaram.
Very well, Aladar said. But Brightness, we have other problems. Surely you've seen the reports. Hatham does an excellent job as High Prince of Works, but there isn't proper infrastructure. The tower has plumbing, but it keeps getting clogged, and the soulcasters work themselves to exhaustion dealing with the waste.
We can't continue pretending the tower can accommodate this population, Brightness Bethab said. Not without a very favorable supply deal from Aesir. Our emerald reserves, despite hunts on the Shattered Plains, are dwindling. Our water carts have to work non-stop.
Equally important, Brightness, Hatham added. We might be facing a severe labor shortage. We have soldiers or caravan men filling in hauling water or packing goods, but they don't like it. Menial carrying is beneath them. We're running low on lumber, Sabariel added. I've tried to claim the forests back near the war camps, but we used to have parchment to cut them. I don't know if I can afford to pay men to do the work instead. But if we don't start something, Thanadol might try to seize them. He's building himself quite the kingdom in the war camps.
This is not a time, Hatham said softly, when we can afford weak leadership. It is not a time when a would-be king can spend his days locked in his rooms. I'm sorry. We are not in rebellion, but we are very concerned.
Navani drew in a breath. Hold it together. Order was the very substance of rule. If things were organized, control could be asserted. She just had to give Dalinar time, even if deep down a part of her was angry. Angry that his pain so overshadowed her growing fear for Elukar and Adolin. Angry that he got to drink himself to oblivion, leaving her to pick up the pieces. But she had learned that nobody was strong all the time. Not even Dalinar Kolin. Love wasn't about being right or wrong, but about standing up and helping when your partner's back was bowed. He would likely do the same for her one day.
Tell us honestly, Brightness, Sabariel said, leaning forward. What does the Blackthorn want? Is this all secretly a way for him to dominate the world?
Storms. Even they worried about it. And why shouldn't they? It made so much sense. My husband wants unity, Navani said firmly, not dominion. You know as well as I do that we could have seized Thalen City. That would have led to selfishness and loss. There is no path through conquest to facing our enemy together.
Aladar nodded slowly. I believe you, and I believe in him.
But how do we survive? Brightness Bethab said.
This tower's gardens once grew food, Navani said. We will figure out how it was done and we will grow here again. The tower once flowed with water. The baths and lavatories prove that. We will delve into the secrets of their fabrials and we will fix the plumbing problems. The tower is above the enemy's storm, supremely defensible and connected to the most important cities in the world. If there is a nation that can stand against the enemy, we will forge it here, with your help and my husband's leadership. They accepted that.
Bless the Almighty, they accepted it.
She made a mental note to burn a glyph word in thanks, then finally took a seat. Together they delved into the tower's most recent list of problems, talking through, as they'd done many times before, the dirty necessities of running a city. 3 hours later, she checked her arm fabrial, a mirror of the one Dalinar carried, with inset clock and newly designed pain rails. 3 hours and 12 minutes since the meeting had begun. Exhaustion Spren had collected to swirl around them all, and she called an end. They'd hashed out their immediate problems, and would summon their various scribes to offer specific revisions. This would keep everyone going a little longer. And bless them, these four did want the Coalition to work. Aladar and Sabariel, for all their flaws, had followed Dalinar into the Dark of the Weeping, and found damnation waiting there. Hatham and Bethab had been at the advent of the new storm, and could see that Dalinar had been right. They didn't care that the Blackthorn was a heretic, or even whether he usurped the throne of Alethkar. They cared that he had a plan for dealing with the enemy, long-term. After the meeting broke, Navani walked off down the strata-lined hallway, trailed by her bridgeman guards, two of whom carried sapphire lanterns. "I do apologize," she noted to them, "for how boring that must have been."
"We like boring, Brightness,"
Leighton, their leader today, said. He was a stocky man with short, curly hair.
"Hey, Hobber, anyone try to kill you in there?"
The gap-toothed bridgeman grinned his reply.
"Does Huyo's breath count?"
"See, Brightness?"
Leighton said.
"New recruits might get bored by guard duty, but you'll never find a veteran complaining about a nice quiet afternoon full of not being stabbed."
"I can see the appeal," she said. "But surely it can't compare with soaring through the skies."
"That's true," Leighton said. "But we have to take turns, you know."
He meant using the honor blade to practice wind running.
"Cal has to return before we can do more than that."
To a man, they were absolutely certain he'd return, and showed the world jovial faces, though she knew not everything was perfect with them. Teft, for example, had been hauled before Aladar's magistrates 2 days ago. Public intoxication on fire moss. Aladar had quietly requested her seal to free him. No, all was not well with them. But as Navani led them down toward the basement library rooms, a different issue gnawed at her. Bright Lady Bethab's implication that Navani was eager for the chance to take over, while Dalinar was indisposed. Navani was not a fool. She knew how it looked to others. She'd married one king. After he died, she'd immediately gone after the next most powerful man in Alethkar. But she couldn't have people believing she was the power behind the throne. Not only would it undermine Dalinar, but it would grow tedious for her. She had no problem being a wife or mother to monarchs, but to be one herself, storms, what a dark path that would lead them all down. She and the bridgemen passed no fewer than 6 squads of sentries on their way to the library rooms with the murals, and, more importantly, the hidden gemstone records. Arriving, she idled in the doorway, impressed by the operation that Jasnah had organized down here, since Navani had been forced to step back from the research. Each gemstone had been removed from its individual drawer, catalogued, and numbered. While one group listened and wrote, others sat at tables, busy translating. The room buzzed with a low hum of discussion and scratching reeds, concentration spren dotting the air, like ripples in the sky. Jasnah strolled along the tables, looking through pages of translations. As Navani entered, the bridgeman gathered around Renarin, who blushed, looking up from his own papers, which were covered in glyphs and numbers. He did look out of place in the room, the only man in uniform, rather than in the robes of an ardent or storm warden. "Mother," Jasnah said, not looking up from her papers, "we need more translators. Do you have any other scribes versed in classical Alethalan?" "I've lent you everyone I have. What is Renarin studying over there?" "Hmm? Oh, he thinks there might be a pattern to which stones were stored in which drawers. He's been working on it all day."
"And?"
"Nothing, which is not surprising. He insists he can find a pattern if he looks hard enough." Jasnah lowered her pages and looked at her cousin, who was joking with the men of Bridge 4. storms, Navani thought. He truly looks happy. Embarrassed as they ribbed him, but happy. She'd worried when he had first joined Bridge Four. He was the son of a high prince. Decorum and distance were appropriate when dealing with enlisted soldiers. But when, before this, had she last heard him laugh? Maybe, Navani said, we should encourage him to take a break and go out with the bridgemen for the evening. I'd rather keep him here, Yasna said, flipping through her pages. His powers need additional study. Navani would talk to Renarin anyway, and encourage him to go out more with the men. There was no arguing with Yasna, any more than there was arguing with a boulder. You just stepped to the side and went around. The translation goes well? Navani asked. Other than the bottleneck on numbers of scribes? We're lucky, Yasna said, that the gemstones were recorded so late in the life of the Radiance. They spoke a language we can translate, if it had been the Dawn Chant. That's close to being cracked. Yasna frowned at that. Navani had thought the prospect of translating the Dawn Chant and writings lost to the Shadow Days would have excited her. Instead, it seemed to trouble her. Have you found anything more about the Tower's Fabrials in these gemstone records? Navani asked. I'll be certain to prepare a report for you, Mother, with details of each and every Fabrial mentioned. So far, those references are few. Most are personal histories. Damnation! Mother! Yasna said, lowering her pages. What? I wouldn't have thought you would object to a few strong words now. It's not the language, but the dismissal, Yasna said. Histories!
Oh, right.
History is the key to human understanding.
Here we go.
We must learn from the past and apply that knowledge to our modern experience.
Lectured by my own daughter again.
The best indication of what human beings will do is not what they think, but what the record says similar groups have done in the past.
Of course, Brightness.
Yasna gave her a dry look, then set her papers aside. I'm sorry, Mother. I've been dealing with a lot of lesser ardents today. My didactic side might have inflated.
You have a didactic side? Dear, you hate teaching.
Which explains my mood, I should think. A young scribe called for her from the other side of the room. Yasna sighed, then went to answer the question. Yasna preferred to work alone, which was odd, considering how good she was at getting people to do what she wanted. Navani liked groups, but of course Navani wasn't a scholar. Oh, she knew how to pretend, but all she really did was nudge here and there, perhaps provide an idea. Others did all the real engineering. She poked through the papers Yasna had set aside. Perhaps her daughter had missed something in the translations. To her mind, the only scholarship of importance was stuffy, dusty writings of old philosophers. When it came to Fabrials, Yasna barely knew her pairings from her warnings. What was this? The glyphs were scrawled in white on the High Prince's wall, the paper read. We quickly ascertained the implement of writing to be a stone pried free near the window. This first sign was the roughest of them, the glyphs malformed. The reason for this later became apparent, as Prince Renarin was not versed in writing glyphs, save the numbers. The other pages were similar, talking about the strange numbers found around Dalinar's palace in the days leading up to the Everstorm. They'd been made by Renarin, whose Spren had given him warning that the enemy was preparing an assault. The poor boy, uncertain of his bond and frightened to speak out, had instead written the numbers where Dalinar would see them. It was a little odd, but in the face of everything else, it didn't really register. And, well, it was Renarin. Why had Yasna collected all of these? I have a description for you finally, Yasna, another said. We've convinced the Radiant that Lift found in Yedaw to visit Azamir. Though she has not yet arrived, you can find sketches of her Spren companion here. It looks like the shimmer you see on a wall when you shine light through a crystal. Troubled, Navani set the sheets down before Yasna could return. She got a copy of the translated portions from the gemstones. Several young scribes were assigned to making these available. Then slipped out to go check on Dalinar.
105. Spirit, Mind, and Body. 6 years ago. Only the very most important people were allowed to watch Gavilar's holy interment. Dalinar stood at the front of the small crowd gathered in the royal catacombs of Kolinar, beneath the stone site of kings. Fires burned at the sides of the room, a primal light, traditional. Distinctly more alive than the light of spheres, it reminded him of the rift. But for once, that pain was overpowered by something new. A fresh wound. The sight of his brother lying dead on the slab.
"Spirit, mind, and body," the wizened Ardent said, her voice echoing in the stone catacomb. "Death is the separation of the three. The body remains in our realm to be reused. The spirit rejoins the pool of divine essence that gave it birth. And the mind goes to the Tranquiline Halls to find its reward."
Dalinar's nails bit his skin as he clenched his hands into fists, tight, to keep him from trembling.
"Gavilar the Majestic," the Ardent continued, "first king of Alethkar in the new Kolin dynasty, 32nd high prince of the Kolin princedom, heir of the Sunmaker and blessed of the Almighty. His accomplishments will be lauded by all, and his dominion extends to the hereafter. Already he leads men again on the battlefield, serving the Almighty in the true war against the Voidbringers."
The Ardent thrust a bony hand toward the small crowd.
"Our king's war has moved to the Tranquiline Halls. The end of our war for Roshar did not end our duty to the Almighty. Think upon your callings, men and women of Alethkar. Think of how you might learn here and be of use in the next world."
Yevana would use any available opportunity to preach. Dalinar clenched his hands tighter, angry at her, angry at the Almighty. Dalinar should not have lived to see his brother die. This was not the way it should have gone. He felt eyes on his back. Collected high princes and wives, important Ardents, Navani, Yasna, Elokar, Aesodon, Dalinar's sons. Nearby, High Prince Sabario glanced at Dalinar, eyebrows raised. He seemed to be expecting something. "I'm not drunk, you idiot," Dalinar thought. "I'm not going to make a scene to amuse you." Things have been going better lately. Dalinar had started controlling his vices. He'd confined his drinking to monthly trips away from Kolinar, visiting outer cities. He said the trips were to let Elokar practice ruling without Dalinar looking over his shoulder, as Gavilar had been spending more and more time abroad. But during those trips, Dalinar drank himself to oblivion, letting himself escape the sounds of children crying for a few precious days. Then, when he returned to Kolinar, he controlled his drinking. And he'd never again yelled at his sons, as he had at poor Renarin during that day on the way back from the Shattered Plains. Adolin and Renarin were the only pure remnant of Evie. "If you control your drinking when back in Kolinar," a part of him challenged, "what happened at the feast? Where were you when Gavilar was fighting for his life?"
"We must use King Gavilar as a model for our own lives," the Ardent was saying. "We must remember that our lives are not our own. This world is but the skirmish to prepare us for the true war."
"And after that?" Dalinar asked, looking up from Gavilar's corpse. The Arden squinted, adjusting her spectacles.
"High Prince Dalinar?"
"After that, what?" Dalinar said. "After we win back the Tranquiline Halls, what then? No more war? Is that when we finally get to rest?"
"You needn't worry, Blackthorn," Yavenna said. "Once that war is won, the Almighty will certainly provide for you another conquest."
She smiled comfortingly, then moved on to the ritual sayings. A series of kedeks, some traditional, others composed by female family members for the event. Ardents burned the poems as prayers in braziers. Dalinar looked back down at his brother's corpse, which stared upward, lifeless blue marbles replacing his eyes. "Brother," he'd said, "follow the codes tonight. There is something strange upon the winds." Dalinar needed something to drink, Stormit.
"You, always about dreams. My soul weeps. Farewell, weeping soul. My dreams about always you."
The poem slapped him harder than the others. He sought out Navani and knew instantly that the Kedek had been hers. Gazing straight ahead, she stood with one hand on Elikar's, King Elikar's, shoulder. So beautiful. Next to her, Yasna stood with arms wrapped around herself, eyes red. Navani reached toward her, but Yasna pulled away from the others and stalked off toward the palace proper. Dalinar wished he could do the same, but instead drew himself to attention. It was over. He'd never have a chance to live up to Gavilar's expectations. Dalinar would live the rest of his life as a failure to this man whom he had loved so dearly. The hall grew still, quiet save for the crinkling sound of paper burning in the fires. The soulcaster stood up, and old Yavenna stepped hastily backward. She wasn't comfortable with what was coming next. None of them were, judging by the shuffling feet, the coughs into hands. The soulcaster might have been male, might have been female. Hard to say with that hood up over their face. The skin beneath was colored like granite, cracked and chipped, and seemed to glow from within. The soulcaster regarded the corpse, head cocked, as if surprised to find a body here. They ran their fingers along Gavilar's jaw, then brushed the hair off his forehead. "The only part of you that is true," the soulcaster whispered, tapping a stone that had replaced one of the king's eyes. Then light emerged as the soulcaster drew their hand from their pocket, revealing a set of gemstones bound into a fabrial. Dalinar didn't look away, despite how the light made his eyes water. He wished he'd taken a drink or two before coming. Was he really supposed to watch something like this while sober? The soulcaster touched Gavilar on the forehead, and the transformation happened instantly. One moment Gavilar was there, the next he had become a statue. The soulcaster slipped a glove onto their hand, while other Ardents hurried to remove the wires that had held Gavilar's body in position. They used levers to tip him carefully forward until he was standing, holding a sword with point toward the ground, his other hand outstretched. He stared toward eternity, crown on his head, the curls of his beard and hair preserved delicately in the stone. A powerful pose. The mortuary sculptors had done a fantastic job. The Ardents pushed him back into an alcove where he joined the lines of other monarchs, most of them high princes of the Kolin princedom. He would be forever frozen here, the image of a perfect ruler in his prime. Nobody would think of him as he'd been that terrible night, broken from his fall,
his grand dreams cut short by treason.
"I'll have vengeance, mother," Elikar whispered. "I'll have it."
The young king spun toward the gathered light eyes, standing before his father's outstretched stone hand.
"You've each come to me privately to give support. Well, I demand you swear it in public. Today, we make a pact to hunt those who did this. Today, Alethkar goes to war."
He was greeted by stunned silence.
"I swear it," Torol Sadius said. "I swear to bring vengeance to the traitorous Parshmen, your majesty. You can depend upon my sword."
Good, Dalinar thought, as others spoke up. This would hold them together. Even in death, Gavilar provided an excuse for unity. Unable to stand that stone visage any longer, Dalinar left, stumping into the corridor toward the palace proper. Other voices echoed after him as high princes swore. If Elokar was going to chase those Parshendi back toward the plains, he'd expect the Blackthorn's help. But Dalinar hadn't been that man for years. He patted his pocket, looking for his flask. Damnation. He pretended he was better these days, kept telling himself he was in the process of finding a way out of this mess, of returning to the man he'd once been. But that man had been a monster. Frightening that nobody had blamed him for the things he'd done. Nobody but Evie, who had seen what the killing would do to him. He closed his eyes, hearing her tears. "Father?" a voice said from behind. Dalinar forced himself to stand upright, turning as Adolin scrambled up to him.
"Are you well, father?"
"Yes," Dalinar said. "I just need to be alone."
Adolin nodded.
Almighty above, the boy had turned out well, through little effort of Dalinar's.
Adolin was earnest, likable, and a master of the sword. He was truly capable in modern Alethi society, where how you moved among groups was even more important than strength of arm. Dalinar had always felt like a tree stump in those kinds of settings. Too big, too stupid.
"Go back," Dalinar said. "Swear for our house on this vengeance pact."
Adolin nodded, and Dalinar continued onward, fleeing those fires below. Gavilar's stare judging him, the cries of people dying in the rift. By the time he reached the steps, he was practically running. He climbed one level, then another. Sweating, frantic, he raced through ornate hallways, past carved walls, sedate woods, and accusatory mirrors. He reached his chambers and scrabbled in his pockets for the keys. He'd locked the place tight. No more would Gavilar sneak in to take his bottles. Bliss waited inside. No, not bliss. Oblivion. Good enough. His hands wouldn't stop shaking. He couldn't. It... "Follow the codes tonight." Dalinar's hands trembled and he dropped the keys. "There is something strange upon the winds. Screams for mercy.
Get out of my head. All of you, get out!"
In the distance, a voice. "You must find the most important words a man can say."
Which key was it?
He got one into the lock, but it wouldn't turn. He couldn't see. He blinked, feeling dizzy.
"Those words came to me from one who claimed to have seen the future," the voice said, echoing in the hallway.
Feminine. Familiar.
"How is this possible?" I asked in return. "Have you been touched by the void?" The reply was laughter. "No, sweet king. The past is the future, and as each man has lived, so must you. So I can but repeat what has been done before? In some things, yes. You will love, you will hurt, you will dream, and you will die. Each man's past is your future." "Then what is the point?" I asked, "if all has been seen and done." "The question," she replied,
is not whether you will love, hurt, dream, and die. It is what you will love, why you will hurt, when you will dream, and how you will die. This is your choice. You cannot pick the destination, only the path.
Dalinar dropped the keys again, sobbing. There was no escape. He would fall again. Wine would consume him like a fire consumed a corpse, leaving only ash. There was no way out.
"This started my journey," the voice said, "and this begins my writings. I cannot call this book a story, for it fails at its most fundamental to be a story. It is not one narrative, but many. And though it has a beginning, here on this page, my quest can never truly end. I wasn't seeking answers. I felt that I had those already. Plenty in multitude from a thousand different sources. I wasn't seeking myself. This is a platitude that people have ascribed to me, and I find the phrase lacks meaning. In truth, by leaving, I was seeking only one thing, a journey."
For years it seemed that Dalinar had been seeing everything around him through a haze. But those words, something about them, could words give off light? He turned from his door and walked down the corridor searching for the source of the voice. Inside the royal reading room he found Jasnah, with a huge tome set before her at a standing table. She read to herself, turning to the next page, scowling.
"What is that book?"
Dalinar asked. Jasnah started. She wiped her eyes, smearing the makeup, leaving her eyes clean but raw. Holes in a mask.
"This is where my father got that quote," she said.
"The one he wrote as he died.
Only a few knew of that."
"What book is it?"
"An old text," Jasnah said. "Ancient, once well regarded. It's associated with the Lost Radiance, so nobody references it anymore. There has to be some secret here. A puzzle behind my father's last words. A cipher? But what?"
Dalinar settled down into one of the seats. He felt as if he had no strength.
"Will you read it to me?"
Jasnah met his eyes, chewing her lip as she'd always done as a child. Then she read in a clear, strong voice, starting over from the first page, which he'd just heard. He had expected her to stop after a chapter or two, but she didn't, and he didn't want her to. Dalinar listened, rapt. People came to check on them. Some brought Jasnah water to drink. For once, he didn't ask them for anything. All he wanted was to listen. He understood the words, but at the same time he seemed to be missing what the book said. It was a sequence of vignettes about a king who left his palace to go on a pilgrimage. Dalinar couldn't define, even to himself, what he found so striking about the tales. Was it their optimism? Was it the talk of paths and choices? It was so unpretentious, so different from the boasts of society or the battlefield. Just a series of stories, their morals ambiguous. It took almost 8 hours to finish, but Jasnah never gave any indication she wanted to stop. When she read the last word, Dalinar found himself weeping again. Jasnah dabbed at her own eyes. She had always been so much stronger than he was, but here they shared an understanding. This was their sending off to Gavilar's soul. This was their farewell. Leaving the book on the lectern, Jasnah walked over to Dalinar as he stood up. They embraced, saying nothing. After a few moments, she left. He went to the book, touching it,
feeling the lines of the writing stamped into its cover. He didn't know how long he'd been standing there when Adolin peeked in. "Father, we're planning to send expeditionary forces to the Shattered Plains. Your input would be appreciated."
"I must," Dalinar whispered. "Go on a journey."
"Yeah," Adolin said. "It's a long way. Might get some hunts in while we're on our way, if there's time. Elikar wants these barbarians wiped out quickly. We could be gone and back in a year."
Paths.
Dalinar could not choose his end, but perhaps his path.
"The old magic can change a person," Evie had said. "Make something great of them."
Dalinar stood up taller. He turned and stepped toward Adolin, seizing him by the shoulder.
"I've been a poor father these last few years," Dalinar said.
"Nonsense," Adolin said.
"I've been a poor father," Dalinar repeated, raising his finger. "To you and your brother both. You should know how proud I am of you."
Adolin beamed, glowing like a sphere right after a storm. Glory Spren sprang up around him.
"We will go to war together," Dalinar said, "like we did when you were young. I will show you what it is to be a man of honor. But first, I need to take an advance force without you, I'm afraid, and secure the Shattered Plains."
"We talked about that," Adolin said, eager. "Like your elites from before. Fast, quick. You'll march..."
"Sail," Dalinar said.
"Sail?"
"The rivers should be flowing," Dalinar said. "I'll march south, then take a ship to Dumadari. From there, I'll sail to the Ocean of Origins and make landfall at New Natanin. I'll move in toward the Shattered Plains with my force and secure the region, preparing for the rest of you to arrive."
"That would be a sound idea, I guess," Adolin said.
It was sound.
Sound enough that when one of Dalinar's ships was delayed, and Dalinar himself remained in port, sending most of his force on without him, nobody would think it strange. Dalinar did get himself into trouble. He would swear his men and sailors to secrecy and travel a few months out of his way before continuing on to the Shattered Plains. Evie had said the old magic could transform a man. It was about time he started trusting her. 106. Law is Light. I find Ba-Edo Mishram to be the most interesting of the Unmade. She is said to have been keen of mind, a high princess among the enemy forces, their commander during some of the desolations. I do not know how this relates to the ancient god of the enemy named Odium. From Hesse's Mythica, page 224. Zeth of Shinovar flew with the Skybreakers for 3 days southward. They stopped several times to recover hidden stockpiles in mountain peaks or remote valleys. To find doorways, they often had to hack through 5 inches of creme. That amount of buildup had probably taken centuries to accumulate, yet Nin spoke of the places as if he'd just left. At one, he was surprised to find the food long since decayed, though fortunately the gemstone stockpile there had been hidden in a place where it remained exposed to the storms. In these visits, Zeth finally began to grasp how ancient this creature was. On the 4th day, they reached Marat. Zeth had been to the kingdom before. He had visited most of Roshar during the years of his exile. Historically, Marat wasn't truly a nation, but neither was it a place of nomads like the backwaters of Hexi or Tufalia. Instead, Marat was a group of loosely connected cities, tribally run, with a high prince at their head, though in a local dialect he was called Elder Brother. The country made for a convenient way stop between the Boren kingdoms of the east and the Makabaki ones of the center-west. Zeth knew that Marat was rich in culture, full of people as proud as you'd find in any nation, but of almost no value on the political scale, which made it curious that Nin chose to end their flight here. They landed on a plain full of strange brown grass that reminded Zeth of wheat,
save for the fact that this pulled down into burrows, leaving visible only the small bob of grain on the top. This was casually eaten by wild beasts that were wide and flat, like walking discs, with claws only on the underside to shove the grain into their mouths. The disc-like animals would probably migrate eastward. Their droppings containing seeds that stuck to the ground would survive storms to grow into first-stage polyps. Those would later blow to the west and become second-stage grain. All life worked in concert, he'd been taught in his youth. Everything but men, who refused their place, who destroyed instead of added. Nin spoke briefly with Ki and the other masters, who took to the air again. The others joined them, all but Zeth and Nin himself, and streaked toward a town in the distance. Before Zeth could follow, Nin took him by the arm and shook his head. Together the two of them flew to a smaller town on a hill near the coast. Zeth knew the effects of war when he saw them. Broken doors, ruins of a short breached wall. The destruction looked recent, though any bodies had been cleaned out and the blood had been washed away by high storms. They landed before a large stone building with a peaked roof. Mighty doors of soul-cast bronze lay broken off in the rubble. Zeth would be surprised if somebody didn't return to claim those for their metal. Not every army had access to soul casters.
"Aw," the sword said from his back. "We missed the fun."
"That tyrant in Tukar," Zeth said, looking through the silent town. "He decided to end his war against Imul and expand eastward?"
"No," Nin said. "This is a different danger." He pointed toward the building with the broken doors. "Can you read that writing above the doorway, Zeth son Naturo?" "It's in the local language. I don't know the script, Aboshi."
The divine honorific was his best guess of how to address one of the heralds, though among his people it had been reserved for the great spren of the mountains.
"It says justice," Nin said. "This was a courthouse."
Zeth followed the herald up the steps and into the cavernous main room of the ruined courthouse. In here, sheltered from the storm, they found blood on the floor. No bodies, but plenty of discarded weapons, helms, and, disturbingly, the meager possessions of civilians. The people had likely taken refuge inside here during the battle, a last grasp at safety.
"The ones you call Parshmen name themselves the Singers," Nin said. "They took this town and pressed the survivors into labor at some docks farther along the coast." "Was what happened here justice, Zeth son Naturo?"
"How could it be?" He shivered. The dark reaches of the room seemed to be filled with haunted whispers. He drew closer to the herald for safety.
"Ordinary people, living ordinary lives, suddenly attacked and murdered?" "A poor argument. But if the lord of this city had stopped paying his taxes, then forced his people to defend the city when higher authorities arrived and attacked, is not a prince justified in maintaining order in his lands? Sometimes it is just to kill ordinary people."
"But that did not happen here," Zeth said. "You said this was caused by an invading army."
"Yes," Nin said softly. "This is the fault of invaders. That is true."
He continued walking through the hollow room, Zeth staying close behind him.
"You are in a unique position, Zeth son Naturo. You will be the first to swear the oaths of a skybreaker in a new world, a world where I have failed."
They found steps near the back wall. Zeth got out a sphere for light, as Nin did not appear to be so inclined. That drove the whispers back.
"I visited Ishar," Nin continued. "You call him Ishu Sun God. He has always been the most wise of us. I did not want to believe what had happened."
Zeth nodded. He had seen that. After the first Everstorm, Nin had insisted that the Voidbringers hadn't returned. He had given excuse after excuse. until eventually he'd been forced to admit what he was seeing.
"I worked for thousands of years to prevent another desolation," Nin continued. "Ishar warned me of the danger. Now that Honor is dead, other Radiants might upset the balance of the Oath Pact, might undermine certain measures we took, and give an opening to the enemy."
He stopped at the top of the steps and looked down at his hand, where a glistening shard blade appeared, one of the two missing honor blades. Zeth's people had care of 8. Once, long ago, it had been 9. Then this one had vanished. He'd seen depictions of it, strikingly straight and unornamented for a shard blade, yet still elegant. 2 slits ran the length of the weapon, gaps that could never exist in an ordinary sword as they would weaken it. They walked along a loft at the top of the courtroom. Records storage, judging by the scattered ledgers on the floor.
"You should draw me,"
the sword said.
"And do what, Sword Nimi?"
Zeth whispered.
"Fight him. I think he might be evil."
"He is one of the heralds, one of the least evil things in the world."
"Huh. Doesn't bode well for your world, then. Anyway, I'm better than that sword he has. I can show you."
Picking his way past the legal debris, Zeth joined Nin beside the loft's window. In the distance, farther along the coast, a large bay glistened with blue water. Many masts of ships gathered there, figures buzzing around them.
"I have failed," Nin repeated. "And now, for the people, justice must be done. A very difficult justice, Zeth son Naturo, even for my Skybreakers. We will endeavor to be as passionless and logical as you, Aboshi."
Nin laughed. It didn't seem to carry the mirth that it should have.
"Me? No, Zeth son Naturo. I am hardly passionless. This is the problem."
He paused, staring out the window at the distant ships.
"I am different from how I once was. Worse, perhaps. Despite all that, a part of me wishes to be merciful."
"And is mercy such a bad thing, Aboshi?"
"Not bad, merely chaotic. If you look through the records in this hall, you will find the same story told again and again. Leniency and mercy. Men set free despite crimes because they were good fathers, or well-liked in the community, or in the favor of someone important. Some of those who are set free change their lives and go on to produce for society. Others recidivate and create great tragedies. The thing is, Zeth son Naturo, we humans are terrible at spotting which will be which. The purpose of the law is so we do not have to choose, so our native sentimentality will not harm us."
He looked down again at his sword.
"You," he said to Zeth, "must choose a third ideal. Most Skybreakers choose to swear themselves to the law, and follow with exactness the laws of whatever lands they visit. That is a good option, but not the only one. Think wisely and choose."
"Yes, Aboshi," Zeth said.
"There are things you must see, and things you must know before you can speak. The others must interpret what they have sworn before, and I hope they will see the truth. You will be the first of a new order of Skybreakers."
He looked back out the window.
"The singers allowed the people of this town to return here to burn their dead, a kinder gesture than most conquerors would allow."
"Aboshi, may I ask you a question?"
"Law is light, and darkness does not serve it. Ask, and I will answer."
"I know you are great, ancient, and wise," Zeth said, "but
to my lesser eyes. You do not seem to obey your own precepts. You hunted surge-binders, as you said.
I obtained legal permission for the executions I performed.
Yes, Zeth said. But you ignored many lawbreakers to pursue these few. You had motives beyond the law, Aboshi. You were not impartial. You brutally enforced specific laws to achieve your ends.
This is true.
So is this just your own sentimentality?
In part, though I have certain leniencies. The others have told you of the fifth ideal,
the ideal where the Skybreaker becomes the law.
Nin held out his empty left hand. A shard blade appeared there, different and distinct from the honor blade he carried in the other hand.
I am not only a herald, but a Skybreaker of the fifth ideal. Though I was originally skeptical of the Radiance, I believe I am the only one who eventually joined his own order. And now, Zeth, son Naturo, I must tell you of the decision we heralds made long ago. On the day that would become known as Ahari Etiam, the day we sacrificed one of our own to end the cycle of pain and death.
107. The First Step. There is very little information about Ba Edo Mishram in more modern times. I can only assume she, unlike many of them, returned to damnation or was destroyed during Ahari Etiam. From Hesse's Mythica, page 226. Dalinar found a wash basin ready for him in the morning. Navani meticulously kept it filled, just as she cleaned up the bottles and allowed the servants to bring him more. She trusted him better than he trusted himself. Stretching in his bed, Dalinar woke feeling far too whole, considering the drinking he'd been doing. Indirect sunlight illuminated the room from the window. Normally they kept the shutters in this room closed to ward off the cold mountain air. Navani must have opened them after rising. Dalinar splashed his face with water from the basin, then caught a hint of his own scent.
Right.
He looked into one of the connecting rooms, which they'd appropriated for a washroom, as it had a back entrance the servants could use. Sure enough, Navani had ordered the tub filled for him. The water was cold, but he'd known his share of cold baths. It would keep him from lingering. A short time later, he took a razor to his face, peering at himself in a bedroom mirror. Gavilar had taught him to shave. Their father had been too busy getting himself cut apart in foolish duels of honor, including the one where he'd taken a blow to the head. He'd never been right after that. Beards were unfashionable in Alethkar these days, but that wasn't why Dalinar shaved. He liked the ritual. The chance to prepare, to cut away the nightly chaff and reveal the real person underneath, furrows, scars, and harsh features included. A clean uniform and underclothes waited for him on a bench. He dressed, then checked the uniform in the mirror, pulling down on the bottom of the coat to tighten any folds. That memory of Gavilar's funeral, so vivid. He'd forgotten parts. Had that been the Night Watcher or the natural course of memories? The more he recovered of what he had lost, the more he realized that the memories of men were flawed. He'd mention an event now fresh to his mind, and others who had lived it would argue over details as each recalled it differently. Most, Navani included, seemed to remember him as more noble than he deserved. Yet he didn't ascribe any magic to this. It was simply the way of human beings, subtly changing the past in their minds to match their current beliefs. But then, that vision with Noadon, where had that come from? Just a common dream? Hesitant, he reached out to the Stormfather, who rumbled distantly.
Still there, I see, Dalinar said, relieved.
Where would I go?
I hurt you, Dalinar said. When I activated the Oath Gate, I was afraid you would leave me.
This is the lot I have chosen, It is you or oblivion.
I'm sorry, regardless, for what I did. Were you involved in that dream I had? The one with Noadon?
I know of no such dream.
It was vivid, Dalinar said. More surreal than one of the visions, true, but captivating. What was the most important step a man could take? The first, obviously. But what did it mean? He still bore the weight of what he had done at the Rift. This recovery, this stepping away from the week spent drinking, wasn't a redemption. What would he do if he felt the thrill again? What would happen the next time the weeping in his mind became too difficult to bear? Dalinar didn't know. He felt better today, functional. For now, he would let that be enough. He picked a piece of lint off his collar, then belted on a side sword and stepped out of the bedroom, walking through his study and into the larger room with the hearth.
Teravangian? He said, surprised to find the elderly king seated there.
Wasn't there to be a meeting of the monarchs today? He vaguely remembered Navani telling him of it early that morning.
He said I wasn't needed.
Nonsense. We're all needed at the meetings. Dalinar paused.
I've missed several, haven't I?
Well, regardless, what are they talking about today?
Tactics.
Dalinar felt his face go red. The deployment of troops in the defense of Yarkaved, your kingdom?
I think they believe that I will give up the throne of Yarkaved once a suitable local man has been found.
He smiled.
Do not be so outraged on my behalf, my friend. They didn't forbid me. They simply noted I wasn't needed. I wanted some time to think, so I came here.
Still, let's go up, shall we?
Teravangian nodded, standing. He wobbled on unsteady legs, and Dalinar hurried over to help him. Stabilized, Teravangian patted Dalinar's hand.
Thank you. You know, I've always felt old, but lately it seems my body is determined to give me persistent reminders.
Let me summon a palanquin to carry you.
No, please. If I give up walking,